This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And coming today on the show, we'll visit with Foster Campbell, one of the most venerable Louisiana politicians, public service commissioner since 2003, and he was a member of the Louisiana Senate from 1976 to 2003. He'll talk about the changes that have occurred since he left office, or he took office in the year of 1976, the bicentennial year. Politics has certainly evolved since then. And also, there is a move in the Louisiana legislature to hike payday loan rates. We'll discuss it with Foster Campbell. And author Rachel Slade, her book is Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. This is about an amazing event in the Bermuda Triangle in the year of 2015. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill is producing, and your numbers locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. And you can send an email if you so choose to talk@talklouisiana.org. Good to have you aboard. And we start with Foster Campbell, one of the most venerable and outspoken and loquacious Louisiana politicians of any time, and his time has included 1976 to the present, elected to the Louisiana Senate in 1975, where he served for 27 years. And for the last 15 years, Foster Campbell has been a member of the Public Service Commission. He ran for the U.S. Senate 2 years ago and lost a race to John Kennedy. And he's here to talk about a number of things. And we want to start with one of his passions through the years. Commissioner Campbell and Senator Campbell has been a vocal opponent of payday loan rates in Louisiana, and now the Louisiana Senate, as of last week, passed a bill on a 20-17 vote to actually expand the rates, increase them. And this is something that has not generated a whole lot of attention. But Foster Campbell, I know you were quite perplexed that the Senate, with no votes to spare, 20-17, passed this bill last week. What's going on?
I don't know. I know, and all due respect, I probably couldn't have made a difference, but I sure would have loved to have made a speech on that. Let me see if I understand this. Louisiana is one of the poorest states in the United States, and the recipe that or the prescription that we have for our people is the poor people in this state, let's charge them more money to borrow money. Let's charge them a higher rate. In other words, rather than stimulating the estate trying to get money to the people, we want to take more money out of the people, the poorest people in the United States. This is a terrible idea. A lot of states have outlawed payday loan companies, and here we are in Louisiana giving them a way to increase rates. It's a bad thing. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for the people. And I hate it. Now, I hope it gets killed in the House, but I will tell you this. If it doesn't get killed and it goes to the governor's desk, I will ask John Bel Edwards to veto it. I don't know if he will, but I have some good reasons that I would like to share with him. I'm going to ask him to veto it. Hopefully it gets killed in the House. It's no reason in the world for Louisiana. We're down there with Mississippi and New Mexico. It's a lot of people going to work. I agree, but we still have poor people. We have parishes where the average income is $18,000 a year per person. And if someone needs a loan, we're going to charge them more interest, taking blood out of a turnip. I just don't see the reasoning there. I think it's wrong, and it's just about greed. That's all it's about, greed. People want to charge people more money and make it legal to do that. And it's a shame, and it should have never got out of the Senate, and hopefully the House will have more wisdom and kill it.
14 groups have signed an open letter to lawmakers urging opposition to Senate Bill 365, including the Louisiana NAACP, faith groups, advocates for low-income families. It would expand predatory lending in Louisiana by allowing payday and car title lenders to issue installment loans with annual interest rates of up to 167%. It's being pushed by some national loan corporations as a way to evade federal consumer protection legislation. That's according to the ones who are, of course, against this. Now, others believe that this is just the market, and that the market rules everything. Foster Campbell, how do you respond to people who say, look, if people can get that kind of money, more power to them, should receive more attention than it has? And, of course, some of the people like Tom Aswell of Louisiana Voice, who's been on this show many times, Tom doesn't take a whole lot for him to get engaged, and he says of the 20 senators who voted in favor of the bill, 13 have received campaign contributions from these entities, and sometimes that may or may not affect the way lawmakers vote, but those who received campaign contributions include Conrad Appel, Wesley Bishop, Norby Schaubert, Dale Erty, Ronnie Johns, Eric LaFleur, Beth Mizell, Barrow Peacock, Ed Price, and Rick Ward, and they were among the 20, and these are not all Republicans either. Of those who did receive the campaign contributions, Bishop's a Democrat from New Orleans, LaFleur is a Democrat from Ville Platte, and Price is a Democrat from Gonzales. And 14 of the 17 senators who voted against the bill also received a combined total of $34,500, an average of $2,464 each from this industry. And there is some dispute within the industry about whether this is a good thing, that maybe 167% interest rate is not good. Jan Moeller, director of the Louisiana Budget Project, argues that Louisiana's lower-income citizens, upon whom payday loan companies do business with, as you can imagine, they're the ones who need these kinds of things, cannot afford triple-digit interest rates, adding that the bill is being pushed by well-connected lobbyists who say they are selling, in his view, Mower's view, a false narrative. There was a story in the Business Report last week indicating that several lobbyists are working this bill at the Capitol, 15 according to the last count. 877-217-5757 is your number. Phil is on line one. Is that Phil in Jefferson Terrace? Good morning, Phil. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Kim. And just to throw something else into the mix about what to talk to with Mr. Campbell, who's one of my favorite people here in Louisiana, I found out that the last oil refineries built in the country, in the United States, were in 1998, and since 1998 up until recently, there weren't any new refineries built. But guess what? In 2014, since they started building refineries again, and five new refineries have come online since 2014. And guess what happened in 2015? Congress made it legal to sell U.S. oil on the world open market. I think that's a lot of connected dots to be had there, along with the pipeline, because the pipeline is part of that system to bring our oil out onto the open market. So I hope, you know, Foster can really remember that.
Okay. Well, we'll do our best to restore contact with Foster Campbell, who, of course, has been noted as a voice for consumers throughout his tenure, both in the legislature and as a public service commissioner. He's been doing this for 42 years. He ran for the U.S. Senate 2 years ago and did not even get 40% of the votes. It was right under 40. John Neely Kennedy won in a landslide, and Foster Campbell did carry East Baton Rouge Parish, though. He won the parish where this program originates. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. There's an article in Saturday or Sunday's New York Times. I think that it's earth-shaking in its gravity. Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, had a family replete with mob connections in New York, the Russian mob and the Italian mob. For example, his uncle owned the building where Anthony Gaspipe Casso, mass murderer, had an office, and his father-in-law has criminal implications with the Russian mob, and Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, and this will beat Hillary's cattle futures up one side and down the other.
All right. Well, David, that's a topic worthy of another day, but it's not what we're talking about right now. So let's see what we can do about discussing this at some future point. Obviously, President Trump remains a magnet for controversy, and it hasn't been a day without news from the president since he took office January 20th of last year, and here we are almost 16 months later, and the beat goes on. 877-217-5757 and 297-5633 and talk at talklouisiana.org. We're talking right now about payday loans in Louisiana. Opponents say the bill to expand payday lending is greed and arrogance. It passed the Senate 20-17, but proponents say the market rules, and the House and Governor Edwards will weigh in on this at some point. We'll be back after this pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. And we have rejoined the conversation with the veteran lawmaker and Public Service Commissioner Foster L. Campbell, Jr. of Elm Grove, Louisiana. And he is talking about this payday loan bill. He says if he were in the Senate, he would have voted against it. Would have loved to have given a speech, and the bill barely passed 20-17. If approved by the House and signed by Governor Edwards, who also received $6,500 from payday loan contributors, it would create the Louisiana Credit Access Loan Act, which would allow lenders to issue new payday loans from $500 to $875 for terms 3 to 12 months. Present law limits loans of $350 for up to 60 days. The interest rate is pegged at 167% on an annual level. So why did the bill pass? Why do you think it got 20 votes in the Senate, Foster Campbell?
I don't have any idea. I didn't think it had a chance. We've been talking about payday loan companies all over the state of Louisiana. Anybody, any group that you go talk to, if you talk about payday loans, they all think it's terrible. They're charging, like I said before we were cut off, this is the poorest state, one of the poorest states in America. And here we are charging the people in the poorest state higher interest. It doesn't make any sense at all. It's absolutely, like they say, taking blood out of a turnip. Why would you want to do that? Why not stimulate the economy, putting more money in people's pocket where they could spend it and help the economy rather than taking more money out? It's one word that wraps all this up, and it's a very common word that is used a lot, but it's greed. It's people who want to make more money, and they don't care how they make it and who they take it out of the hide of. They're pulling the hide off of people that can't afford it. They're going to say, well, who's going to loan these people money? Well, these people are Americans, and they're Louisiana citizens. And they don't deserve to be treated like this 180% when the prime interest rate today is about 4%, something like that. It has been as low as 2 or 3. It might be 5 for people who have the best credit. But, I mean, it's a long ways from 5 to 180. 5 times 4 is 20%. That'd be a 400% markup. So these guys are just greedy, and they're worried about putting money in their pocket. And they're hurting the state of Louisiana. We ought to follow suit with some of more of the progressive states. They've actually kicked them out of the state. And it's a shame. It's a shame. Hopefully this bill will get killed in the House. And if not, like I said earlier, I'm going to ask John Bel Edwards to veto this bill. It ought to be vetoed. We don't need it. It doesn't help the economy. It hurts the economy.
Well, as mentioned, John Bel Edwards has received $6,500 from payday loan contributors. But 13 senators, and I mentioned this a moment ago, and a listener just asked me to name the 13 who received contributions and still voted against this, were Alario, the Senate President, Dan Clater, Paige Cortez of Lafayette, Jack Donahue Mandeville, Jim Fannin Jonesboro, Gerald Long Winfield, Dan Morris Jennings, Jonathan Perry Kaplan, Neil Reiser, Columbia, John Smith, Leesville, Leon Tarver, Shreveport, Francis Thompson, Delhi, and Mike Walsworth, West Monroe. So, Foster Campbell, apparently, despite the fact that this industry, like many others, nothing wrong with it, contributes to lawmakers and to the governor. Sometimes lawmakers do not always vote with those who contribute to them. They vote their consciences or the will of their constituents.
Well, that's true, and the deal is, though, how much do they give, $250 or $500? So when somebody's running a $300,000, $400,000 campaign, what's a $500 contribution? You know, all the money counts, but anyway, you're supposed to do what you think is right. For John Bell Edwards, who raised $6 or $7 million, you get $6,500. It's nothing. I'm sure he took the money because they are doing business in Louisiana, but that doesn't mean he owes them anything. For $6,500, his race costs $5 or $6 or $7 million, and so $6,500 is nothing. And people are supposed to be able to have fundraisers and accept the money and then vote against them. That's what you're supposed to be able to do. You can take their money and vote against them. That's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes if you don't want to take the money, you ought not take it. You know, just say, hey, I don't like what you're doing. I don't want to take your money at all. And that's the best way to do it, and it's real clear. But sometimes when you're raising money, checks come in, and people put them in the bank. But the bottom line is you're supposed to know better than that. You're supposed to know better.
All right.
Than that.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Foster Campbell.
Yeah, Senator, it sounds like you're in agreement with what President Herbert Hoover said years ago. The only thing wrong with capitalism is capitalists. They're too damn greedy.
Well, Herbert Hoover led us into the Great Depression, so I'm not sure Foster Campbell would prefer to be compared with him. I think you'd rather be compared to FDR. But
let's say this. Anybody can be right.
Even a stop clock twice a day, right?
Yeah. Right. There's no wrong way to do the right thing. But let me just say this. Greed is the biggest problem that we have in government. You know, people want to make more money, and they need to worry about their people. Rather than the special interests. They have taken over not only state government, but federal government. You know, I know all about it. And, hey, look, I'm not a preacher, but it costs millions of dollars to run. And the people they think that they can deal with you are the way they like to say it is we can work with him, which means they pretty much can get them to do what they want. These campaigns, it costs millions and millions and millions of dollars or out of hand, and it hurts the general populace because a lot of times they're not represented because the special interests have already bought and paid for all the legislators, the governors, et cetera.
Well, as we talk about greed and how you believe it's controlling the political arena right now, I mentioned you took office a few years ago, as in 1976, before Jim Leslie was murdered. A lot's happened in 42 years. Is it more greed now, or has this always been part of the process?
It's much more sophisticated now. It costs 10 times more to run. The first time I ran, now this was a long time ago, I borrowed $2,500 from the bank, $2,500, and you could buy 10-second spots on Channel 12 then for $150. And I went over and put out $1,800 to buy some 10-second spots. Hey, I'm Foster Campbell. I'm running for the Senate. Please vote for me. Boom, it was over with. Today, it cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Average people couldn't run today like they could. I ran. It was an 8-man race. I spent $2,500 in the first primary, and we were lucky enough to run high. And got elected on only $6,000 or $7,000. Today, Senate races cost $300,000 to $400,000 or $500,000, and average people have a hard time getting involved in politics because they just don't have the money. And what happens is you have to be well known, or you have to have a lot of money, and it forces the average guy on the street out of politics. And that's a shame, because when it does that, the special interests take over, and they're much. It's much more today than it was in 76. It's just it's very sophisticated, very slick. You have to have the help of Google or the other.
You got to hit a lot of places now, and it costs money to do that. And this bill is one that I think will gain some more attention as it moves along. It didn't get much when it was being considered in the Senate. Proponents of the payday loan bill say that lenders provide a needed service to low-income borrowers who are unable to obtain traditional loans, and it would carry currently a $131 origination fee. Ricky Ward's bill, he's the sponsor of 365, would increase the fees to 270 and the annual interest rate to 167%. And Foster Campbell, we've talked about this before. There are more payday loan locations in Louisiana than there are McDonald's. It is a business that is thriving.
Yeah, and go.
Okay, hold tight. 877-217-5757 is your number. Foster L. Campbell, Jr., Public Service Commissioner from Elm Grove, 42-year veteran of Louisiana politics as an elected official. He's with us for a little while longer, and we're back after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Foster Campbell with us for another segment, the veteran public service commissioner, former state lawmaker. He spent 27 years at the state capitol through the years of Edwin Edwards and the first time, David Treen and Buddy Romer and Edwin Edwards again and Mike Foster. He was there for a lot of gubernatorial administrations, and every year at the Capitol, there are bills that are controversial, and one of them that is currently being discussed is one that has passed the Senate on a 20-17 vote that would increase the payday loan rates to 167% annual interest and fees to $270. This is from Ricky Ward of Port Allen, who is the sponsor of the legislation. The House will decide this, and of course, Governor Edwards, if the House passes it, will have the ultimate authority of whether to sign it or to veto it. And as I mentioned, there are Democrats and Republicans on both sides of this issue. And the legislature now, another change, Foster Campbell, from your days, it's now a predominantly Republican body. When you joined the Senate in 1976, how many Republicans were in the upper chamber?
You had one, and he was a great man and had more sense than almost anybody I ever served with, Edwards Barm from Oak Ridge. He was a very level-headed guy that was could get along with anybody. He was a Republican, but he was kind. He was very, very smart, and he was able to function very well in the Senate back then. Edwin Edwards thought a lot of him. He got along with everybody. Edwards Barm was a great man, and he passed away about a couple of years ago. But he was a great man, and he had a lot of intelligence and a lot of humility.
Now, a listener took exception to me earlier referring to this as predatory lending, and perhaps that is a judgment that I should not have made. But at what point does it become something that is actually helpful to the citizenry to the point where it is taking advantage of citizens? What is the interest rate? Is there a magic number that you have in mind, Foster Campbell?
Let me call it predatory lending, because that's exactly what it is. It's just like a hawk flying over a bunch of little birds and picking them out of the sky. That's all this is. It's straight predatory lending. They don't want to talk about it. But what other adjective would describe somebody that's going to charge 180%, or payday loan companies that charge up to 400%, when the prime interest rate, if they borrow money, is 5 or 6%, or if they have a little trouble at a bank, at least they're borrowing money at 8. Anytime you can quadruple or 50 times your money, what would you call it? I mean, of course they don't like the word predatory, but that's exactly what it is. It's people are being predators, preying on people who are having a hard time. And like I said earlier, here's the state of Louisiana, one of the poorest states in America. And what do we do for our people? We raise the interest rate on them. Now, how can anybody in good conscience think this is right? This is not right. Everybody knows this is not right. This is a bunch of greedy people that want to make more money off the backs of the people of Louisiana who can't afford it. That real simple. There's not even an argument here.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make this thing right. There's no way in the world. I don't care what color you paint it. You can paint it blue. You can paint it red. You can paint it any color. But this is just taking the blood out of the people of Louisiana that don't need that. They need help rather than some kind of extraction of a piece of their hide to for them to make to pay their payments on something. It's ridiculous.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org in our remaining time with Foster Campbell. And Donna, of course, looking at this rate that would go to 167% annually, has a good question. What happens to people who miss their payments, who don't pay on time? Does it get worse for them?
I don't know. I mean, they're going to want you to pay. I know when I first started on payday loan companies, there was a criminal penalty. Can you believe that? If you didn't pay your payday loan, it was a criminal penalty. And I changed that in the law to where it's civil. A civil penalty, but it was a criminal penalty. Like I say, this is something that ought to be, all the church people should be up in a roar about this, because I'm not a preacher now, but the Bible is full about usury rates, charging people too much. It's all about greed, and that's all this is about. They ought to call this the greed bill, because that's exactly what it is. And I don't know, I hadn't talked to John Bell Edwards about this, but I bet you, just knowing him, he wouldn't be real happy with this. I don't think he'd be the kind of guy that'd want to sign a bill like this. I don't know that. I know that he's a good man, and he tries to help people. But once he looks at this, I can't see him wanting to sign this bill. I haven't talked to him about it. Don't know.
Another listener, Michael, says that you are characterized as a populist, and asks, are populists in Louisiana and in the United States a dying breed?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I am a populist. I represent the people. I represent the people's interests over the special interests, and I think that's what politicians ought to do. I didn't get elected to represent Exxon, Chevron, and Shell, or the payday loan companies, or the big banks. Mm-hmm. That's not who elects me. And that's not who I don't do real well at the Chambers of Commerce when they get up and they're all about lobby, Louisiana Association Business and Industry, that's controlled by the big chemical companies and the big oil companies up and down the Mississippi River. I'm not their guy. They're against me because I say things that make them uncomfortable. The whole state should be uncomfortable about this bill. This is an immoral bill, taking money from people who can't afford it just to enrich some people who want more money. That's all this is about.
Tim, and I think I know who this is, Tim asks about your battle many years ago with pawn shop companies. How did that one turn out?
It turned out good. What happened was pawn shops in Louisiana were charging interest, and they was popping up on every corner, and there was no regulation there for them at all. So we made a deal with them. They can charge 20% a month, but they are regulated by the banks, the financial institutions of Louisiana. They can regulate them. If they do something wrong, they can come in, issue a cease and desist. There was no regulation at all. I would have liked to reduce the interest rates, but that's the best I could do. But at least we made sure that a pawn shop that goes in business today in Louisiana has to have a bond. They have to be credible. They can't take your they can't open up in somebody's garage, and when you go back to get your items that you pawned, they're not there. So there's a lot of regulations on pawn shops today that wasn't a long time ago. I mean, until we passed this bill. But they do charge 20% a month, 240% a year, which is high. But this is another thing that you try to reduce the rates now, you'll see how much power they have. But at least we put them under the Office of Financial Institutions, and they are responsible now. They have to have insurance. They have to have a bond put up. And they can be the financial department can issue a cease and desist if they're doing anything wrong.
All right. Another listener asks about the discussion over the Harris legislation, which is also moving in the legislature. This would give Harris a land-based monopoly. The company's enjoyed that in New Orleans now for 30 years, and the last time they got a monopoly like this, they had to pay $150 million to the state up front. This agreement does not call for any upfront payment. The listener, Bud, asks if there should be a payment required for Harris to get this kind of a deal from the state of Louisiana.
Jim, I'm not familiar with the deal they're getting. Tell me about it.
Well, they're basically they would get a 30-year renewal, and they would be privileged to the monopoly they now enjoy, and they are promising to spruce up and expand their location in New Orleans, but there is no down payment that was required first go-around back in the day when one Edwin Washington Edwards was governor of Louisiana. In the state being hard up for money, $150 million in the mid-'80s would be worth at least $300 million now. That would help the state a long way, I would think.
Well, maybe. That's true. I'd look at it real close, but you got to remember one thing now. I didn't vote for any gaming, but I live in a town up here in Bossier City where we have a lot of casinos and a lot of people go to work. Now, we got gaming now. It's not that you're kicking them out. So Harris has done a lot for New Orleans. It's brought a lot of people there. A lot of people go to work.
Created some jobs.
They should do about jobs. There's probably some kind of compromise that could come up with that. They ought to do something because they're in a great spot right there in New Orleans, which they were intended to be. And they have done a lot of good things down there as far as bringing jobs to town and people coming there, so they've spent a lot of money. So I don't know about that issue. I'd have to think about it, and I'd think about a good compromise maybe. If not that much money, maybe see what they would do to improve some neighborhoods and things that needs improving in New Orleans, which they need.
We only have about 45 seconds, but a listener asked a question that I should have asked earlier, noting that the 30-year anniversary of your almost fatal car accident passed a few months ago. How has that affected you? All these years later, what impact did that event have on your life?
Well, it was a terrible accident. I almost died, as you know, and I lost my eye. I think it's made me more determined to do what I think's right. I mean, I was spared there, and I'll tell you this short story.
Okay, we've got 30 seconds.
So I saw a lady on the outside of the Capitol. She had a white stick with a red tip. She was blind. And I asked her, I said, ma'am, how do you stand being blind? It's got to be terrible. She said, no, Mr. Campbell, I saw where you had a wreck. Being blind is not the worst disability.
Hmm. Well, you survived, and obviously Foster Campbell is still in the game. And are you running for re-election to the PSC in 2020?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, tomorrow I understand we'll hear from Senator John Kennedy. We'll talk with him on this show. Thank you, Foster Campbell. It is always a pleasure to hear from you. And we'll be back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And our guest is Rachel Slade, a Boston-based journalist, writer, and editor. Her book is Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. It's about an event that took place a few years ago, October 1, 2015, and it is a harrowing story, and Rachel has told it in a most compelling way. What attracted you to this event? You've written about a lot of things in your home area, but this is something that goes beyond that, and it's a story that needs to be told. But how did you get there? What was the provocation for this book?
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely a departure from what I usually write about. But when I first heard about this ship going down and how we actually lost the ship, and how, you know, it took so long to even find the hull on the ocean floor, I just had to find out more about it. It was a mystery that needed to be solved, and I knew so many people were working on solving that. But even more importantly, I live on the East Coast. There's shipping all around me, and I wanted to understand what kinds of people go into this industry and, you know, understand the importance of the industry and how we could lose a ship.
Well, why did the El Faro sail straight into a Category 3 hurricane?
So that's a very complicated story, which is why I wrote a book, of course. But I think the most, the clearest answer is simply that they had outdated weather forecasting information on the bridge, and this hurricane, which took them down, Hurricane Joaquin, which you've probably never heard of, it was a very compact hurricane, just kicked up so fast that the National Hurricane Center could not keep up with it.
It took a long time, Rachel, but the black box was retrieved. I think it was like 15,000 feet down on the ocean floor. But what did the black box reveal?
So this is the most incredible part of the story. So first we have to note that this is the worst American maritime accident in 35 years. We lost 33 mariners. This is completely unprecedented in the modern age. When we finally did find the black box and bring it back up to the surface, you're right, 3 miles down, just an incredible story in itself. We had 26 hours of conversations on the bridge leading up to the moment when that ship sank. And this is a historic document. This is the longest black box recording in history.
The book is Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. And this is an area that has been controversial for years, decades. Anything about this particular spot that is particularly vulnerable for people sailing there?
Well, you're talking about the Bermuda Triangle, and yes, we have lost planes and ships there, and there's a lot of discussion about strange magnetic experiences there. But really, I think it's just important to understand that this is a major shipping route, and it's where hurricanes are in the United States, off the coast of, you know, Florida. So we get a lot of hurricanes there. And hurricanes, if you've never been through one, well, I'm sure many folks know, I mean, they're absolutely devastating. And this ship was particularly vulnerable to this hurricane because the ship was 40 years old.
Well, something like this happening in the 21st century, it seems like a 19th century tale, a shipwreck that one would not expect in today's contemporary environment with GPS, radar, satellite communications. Were there mistakes made that could have been avoided?
Yes. You know, oftentimes when I was writing this book, I thought of the working title is, how many mistakes, how many bad decisions does it take to sink a container ship, an 800-foot-long container ship? And what I found was many. This was actually probably an accident waiting to happen, and it's absolutely tragic, but it's true. The American Merchant Marine is just about the oldest fleet in the world. Our ships, this ship in particular, was 28 years older than the average ship in American ports. So that includes international ships. So the idea that this ship was so old, it could not have been built the way it was today. And they actually had to steal parts off of scrapped ships just to keep this thing operational. I mean, it was vulnerable. It was absolutely vulnerable.
A major character in your book, Into the Raging Sea, is Captain Michael Davidson. What did you find out about him?
Well, now we know a lot about Davidson because of the black box. We know that Davidson was very seduced by the weather forecasting system that he had aboard. This was a third-party weather forecasting system. It had a beautiful interface, and I think he was very drawn to it. And so he followed that forecast over the regularly updated National Hurricane Center forecast. And it turns out that his third-party software, the one that he really cleaved to so strongly, was woefully outdated, which, of course, when you have a quickly developing storm, misinterpreting that information can be catastrophic. But, you know, like so many mariners, Captain Davidson was being paid very well, but he was very, very concerned about his job security, and he had high expenses, just like all working Americans. And so this, going into this storm, was one way for him, he felt, I think, to prove to the shipping company that he was a strong leader, brave, and willing to take risks to get the cargo there on time, to get it to Puerto Rico on time.
Once El Faro was submerged in this storm, was there any way out? Were there perhaps ways that could have saved the ship and the 33 people aboard?
Jim, so that's the fascinating thing about having this document, this 500-page transcript of the black box. We know that the officers saw what was happening and that the events unfolded so slowly over these 26 hours. So, yes, there was plenty of conversation on the bridge among the officers, and sometimes it did approach the captain saying, we need to get out of here. We need to take a channel that would take us on the lee side of the Bahamas so we could get out of trouble. There were actually three specific moments when they had opportunities to turn around or get out of the path of the storm, but the captain was convinced that they were doing the right thing and maintained their course.
Well, I presume the black box recording, Rachel, goes right up to the time that these people died, these mariners lost their lives. How did you research the story?
Yeah, so we do have the transcript of this, and it is a harrowing thing to read. And, of course, I quote from these folks so much, and I contextualize their conversations because I know so much about them now, because I was able to speak to many of the families who had lost their mariners aboard that specific ship. I also went to the hearings. There were 6 weeks of hearings conducted by the National Transportation Safety Board and the U.S. Coast Guard that interviewed shipping experts, interviewed shipping executives, and, of course, the mariners who knew these folks and knew the ship so well. I also wanted to learn about shipping. I mean, I had never been on a container ship before, so I took a container ship from Italy to Baltimore across the Atlantic. It was 12 days at sea. And I also took several piloting runs with the actual pilot who took El Faro out for her final voyage. So I retraced those steps with the actual pilot taking the ship from Jacksonville out to sea.
A listener asks about the Jones Act. Did it contribute at all to this tragedy?
Thank you, listener. The Jones Act is a terrific piece of legislation. It was actually called the Merchant Marine Act from 1920. It is really there to save our merchant marine and make sure that we have an operational merchant marine that can actually be conscripted during wars to carry troops and material to theaters of war. And that actually did happen in World War II plenty. And I just wanted to mention that the U.S. Merchant Marine, which is not an armed services branch, lost more members than any other armed services branch during World War II in America. So these guys were our heroes. They do not get veterans benefits. Really a tragedy. But yes, that's a long way of contextualizing my answer, which is the Jones Act did play a role here. That ship was a Jones Act ship. It was a very lucrative run between Jacksonville and Puerto Rico, and it was very old because the shipping companies must buy their ships from American shipbuilders. That means that these ships tend to be twice, sometimes three times as expensive as ships built abroad.
The book is Into the Raging Sea from Rachel Slade, and one review says it's a pulse-pounding, perfect storm style tale of a shipping disaster, a nerve-wracking, tension-filled narrative. It's an amazing story and well told by Rachel Slade. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Jim.
And congratulations. And we'll be back tomorrow with, among other guests, Senator John Neely Kennedy. We'll talk to him about Harris and what's going on there, but also about other matters, including whether he might run for governor. Until then, for Becca Dill, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.